Hello and welcome to episode 6, our final episode of the Affinity Finance podcast. I'm Lauren Ashen, Client Relationship Manager at Affinity Finance, and today I'm with Tom Carter from Ropewalk Chambers. We will be discussing misrepresentation claims and professional negligence claims. Welcome back to the podcast, Tom.
Hi, Lauren.
So it's our last one.
Yeah, it's gone so quickly. I can't believe it.
It has. So today we're obviously, like I just mentioned, we're going to be talking about misrepresentation and obviously professional negligence claims. What are the basis of a misrepresentation claim?
Well, a misrepresentation claim for knotweed nearly always is the TA6 form. So anybody that buys or sells a house, the normal law society conditions of sale, you have the classic property information form, the TA6, which has got all sorts of questions. But question 7.8 is about Japanese knotweed. There's a preamble just explaining that Japanese knotweed is an invasive plant and it can take many years to treat. And then the crucial question at 7.8 is the property affected by Japanese knotweed? And there are three boxes you can tick. There's a yes, a no, and a don't know. A misrepresentation claim will be where somebody ticks no or possibly not known or don't know, and that turns out not to be true. The basis for a claim in misrepresentation, you can have all sorts of ways of framing it. You can talk about negligent misrepresentation, negligent misstatement, fraudulent misrepresentation. But in my view, the only kind of misrepresentation claim you need, because it's the most straightforward and it's the best for the claimant, is under section 2.1 of the Misrepresentation Act 1967. And it's effectively, if you show there was a misrepresentation and the buyer entered into a contract after that representation was made, then the burden shifts to the defendant to show that they believed the representation was true and that they had reasonable grounds for believing it was true. And the reasonable grounds point is often where you have the argument. It can be quite a high threshold for a defendant, which is why I think the section 2.1 approach is the best way to look at it. So my takeaway from it really would be, when you're thinking about misrepresentation, think about it within that framework for a section 2.1 type claim. Has there been a misrepresentation? Did the seller believe it was true? And crucially, did they have reasonable grounds to believe it was true? And in a nutshell, those are really the issues you have for a misrep claim.
What would happen then, Tom, if the seller ticked not known on a TA6 form?
That can be more difficult, but it doesn't mean there isn't a claim. If a seller ticks no, it's more straightforward, because if you can show with evidence there was Japanese knotweed at the time of the TA6 and also the time of sale, it doesn't have to be both, but if it's said at the TA6 and then not corrected and continues up to sale, then at the time of sale. If you can show there was knotweed, then it's very straightforward, because there was a misrepresentation and then you have what I spoke about just now about the burden shifts to the defendant. If the seller ticks not known, you need to show that the seller did actually know for there to be a misrepresentation in the first place. So it can be a bit more complicated, but what it means is you just have to assess whether you actually have the evidence. So really the burden's more on the claimant then. Do you have the evidence to show that the seller did actually know? That can be a difficult one. It will depend on the facts of the case, but really you need to be thinking, do I have some evidence to show they actually knew? The obvious things are neighbours, anybody else, sometimes even the gardener who may have worked for the seller. I've had cases where the buyers actually end up keeping the same gardener, and the gardener's the one that ends up being the crucial witness saying, well, actually, seller did know about it because I told them and was doing X, Y, or Z. That's really the thing, is if they tick not known, then you need to show there was a misrepresentation in the first place. So you just need to have some kind of positive evidence that they did actually know about it.
Brilliant. Super. Thank you. So are damages the same in a nuisance claim?
They are, pretty much, with a couple of changes. Diminution in value, which is usually the main head of damages, is the same. The only difference is, in a nuisance claim, you value the house and the diminution at the either date of trial, if the nuisance is ongoing, or when the nuisance ended, if, say, they started treating it properly a year before. With a misrep claim, you value the diminution at the time of sale. So if somebody bought a house in 2017, even if the knotweed's still there, you value what the house was worth at the time of sale, which is nearly always what they actually paid for it, and you value the diminution, the drop at the time of sale. That may be different, it may be the same, but it might be relevant if you've got somebody that bought an old derelict house, they've done a lot of work to improve it, but you're looking at the diminution at the time of the sale. In terms of treatment, yes, again, you can claim for treatment. The costs are usually going to be the same because that's ultimately what a contractor would charge to treat it. And if you buy a house with knotweed, it needs to be treated. So again, you can claim for that. Other damages, damage to patio, etc., that wouldn't normally be included because if you buy a house for X amount, then you're taking it as you see it in terms of how well maintained the patio or walls are. But for diminution and for treatment, the two main ones, yeah, it's exactly the same.
I know we've touched on limitation in a previous episode. I think it was episode 4. What is the limitation period for misrepresentation claims?
Limitation period is 6 years. And because it's based on the agreement between the parties, it runs from date of exchange rather than date of completion. There's no extension for finding out about it later. So it's a hard deadline. Based on contract rather than on tort, like you would have in a nuisance claim. So basically, it's a hard limitation period of 6 years from date of exchange of contracts. There's authority on that, not in the context of knotweed, but about misrepresentations generally. The reason it runs from date of exchange is if a seller makes a representation, so in this case, completes the TA6 and ticks the box saying no or not known, they can change that. But once they've exchanged contracts, the parties are then bound by that. As anybody who deals with conveyancing knows, because once you've exchanged, that's it. And if you try and withdraw, you have all sorts of penalties. For that reason, 6 years, the clock starts to tick from the date of exchange of contracts.
Okay, so 6 years. Thank you. Just moving on to professional negligence claims then, Tom. What kind of professional negligence claims are there?
Most of them, 90%, are against surveyors. Surveyors who carry out pre-purchase surveys, that might be a valuer for the mortgage lender carrying out the standard valuation report, or it might be a surveyor, buyer gets a home buyer's report or one of the three levels of the RICS type report before buying a property and the surveyor fails to notice it. The other kind, which is less common, is a claim against usually a solicitor or conveyancer. It's more rare, but I've had cases where this happens. One example, case where somebody, they actually bought it through a limited company as a investment, but that doesn't matter. But the limited company, the claimant, bought a property from a local authority. And during the usual pre-purchase back and forth, the local authority said to their conveyancers, we don't use the normal law society terms of sale. We don't provide a TA6 form. We have our own effectively preset guidance that we follow. And what that meant was that actually no point during the sale did the local authority ever make any statement one way or the other about Japanese knotweed. And there was also a statement in there talking about only representations in certain forms, so not even by email, would qualify as binding representations. They turned out to be knotweed, and then the claimant's claim wasn't against the seller, the local authority, because there'd been no representation. And even if there had, if it wasn't in one of the designated types within the particular terms of that agreement, it wouldn't have had any effect anyway. So their claim then was against their own solicitors for failing to actually advise them about what that meant and whether or not to agree to it in the first place. And it may be they would have been advised and made an informed decision to do it anyway. But it's a question of informed consent. It's a bit almost like a clinical negligence style case where somebody has to be warned about the risks of an operation. They may choose to do it, but they have to be told. That's less common, but it does come up. And that is something to look at. Usually you'd realise that's relevant if you're thinking about a claim, a misrepresentation claim against a seller, and then it emerges that actually they're not liable because there was never a TA6. That's a standard that you might realise it's relevant. But 90% of them, I'd say, are against surveyors for failing to spot knotweed.
So with those 90 then that are against the surveyors, what evidence do you need to show that the surveyor was negligent?
Good question. It can be difficult. Usually the question comes down to whether there was actually knotweed visible at the time. So if a surveyor goes to do an inspection in, say, July, and it's middle of the growing season and the sellers haven't done anything to cut back the knotweed, they've done nothing at all, and it's just growing in the garden. Well, in that case, it's there to be seen, and it can be assumed fairly safely, I've never had a case where this has been an issue, that a reasonably competent surveyor should be able to identify knotweed if they see it. So if it's there to be seen and they don't see it, then they're negligent. Where it becomes more complicated is if a surveyor inspects in winter. Now, if there are dead canes, because it dies back, the sellers don't remove them, surveyors normally would be expected to recognise dead winter canes. So again, no problem. But what you might have is knotweed grown behind a shed. Maybe in the summer it grows high enough that you can see it over the roof of the shed, but it dies back in winter and the dead winter canes are behind the shed where it would be difficult to see them. And usually the terms of survey talk about not going into areas which are difficult to access, etc. So depending on the layout, that might not be possible. Often for the claimant, the buyer, they're not necessarily privy to that because they don't know whether the seller did anything, either to deliberately conceal it or to cut it back. They don't necessarily know what the conditions were like. They may have gone around to do their own viewing, but they weren't looking for knotweed. So the evidence you normally need are ideally photographs from the time to show the state of the knotweed. And it may be that there aren't any from the time. There may be some in the, sometimes even the estate agent's listings. If you look carefully, you can actually spot the knotweed. And if you do, then clearly it was there to be seen. But if you can't see it in the estate agent listing, then really the main evidence you want is photographs from the claimants as soon as possible after they've bought it. And then you might need the knotweed expert to actually extrapolate to establish whether it was there to be seen. And that's really the question against the surveyor. The one thing I would say on this is you often get back and forth between surveyor on one hand, sellers on the other hand. So the sellers will say, oh, well, you had a survey anyway, surveyor should have spotted it. Surveyor often, in a letter of claim to a surveyor, the response will end up making you realise there's actually a stronger claim against the seller. So the surveyor might say, well, actually, there was nothing there to be seen. You've got the photographs from the claimant just after they've moved in showing it's very mature and large in size. That would suggest it had to have been cut back. And if actually the seller had cut it back, then that tends to suggest, unless they cleared the whole garden, which is unusual, if they just cut back the knotweed, that shows, I think, that they did actually know there was Japanese knotweed. So going back to your question about the not known, that might end up being quite helpful evidence. But for the surveyor, really, that's what you want, is what was the size and location of the knotweed at the time they did their inspection, and can you establish that it was actually there to be seen so that they should have picked it up?
Great. Thank you, Tom. I know we've touched on the limitation for misrepresentation claims. Is that the same for professional negligence claims?
It's a bit different. It's more like a nuisance claim. So even if you have a surveyor who the buyers contracted themselves, so you have a potential claim in contract as well as negligence, the reality is it's more like a nuisance claim where you've got the 6 years, but you also have the additional 3 years based on date of knowledge. So if claimant buys a house, they've had a survey, surveyor failed to pick up the knotweed when they should have done, but they don't actually know there's knotweed for another 5 years, say, then they get the 3 years from date of knowledge. So it's more like a nuisance claim. The only thing I would say on that that I have to be a bit careful about is in a nuisance claim, often the clock never even starts ticking because there's been no treatment. So there's a continuing nuisance, and often you would end up not having to think about limitation at all. But in this kind of case, you do have the date of knowledge question, but if it's already been purchased, which it will have done, then the clock has actually started ticking. So it's more like a nuisance case, 6 years or three from date of knowledge if later, but just not with the ongoing position with the continuing nuisance that you get in a nuisance claim.
Okay, no, that makes sense. Thank you. And I just have one last question. I don't know whether this is something that would happen, but or if it has and you've got experience of it, but if there are multiple defendants, how would you pursue?
Yeah, so if you imagine a situation where you've got every possible defendant, you've got a nuisance claim, you've got the neighbour next door with knotweed growing into the garden, you've got the surveyor who failed to pick it up, and you've got the sellers for misrepresentation, because let's just say they said no on the TA6 form. It often will just be a case of looking at the facts and saying, Who are their good claims against? If there's a good claim against everybody, then I don't think there's a problem at all with pursuing all three. That's no problem at all. Sometimes it can end up actually that there's a better claim against one or two rather than all three. And that's really how I think you have to decide. It's on a case by case basis. Sometimes there are particular considerations. So with a misrepresentation claim, if it's a relatively low value property, you might be thinking, well, we can probably win and get judgment, but will the defendants actually be able to satisfy the judgment? Whereas if you go against a surveyor who's insured, or maybe the next door neighbour, if it's a large defendant, say Network Rail as an obvious example, then it might be that for practical reasons, you think, well, actually, we're not going to pursue the sellers, but we'll pursue the neighbour or the surveyor. It might be the other way around. You might have the £1 million house, no worries about the sellers being able to satisfy a judgment for diminution of, say, 50,000. But you might have the neighbour next door might just be a commercial premises or another homeowner who actually you worry doesn't have money. So there's that practical consideration. There's also, as I say, just purely looking at the facts. And then sometimes, as we spoke about a few minutes ago, you can start off sending letters of claim to all three. And then as everything starts to fall into place, sometimes it does tend to naturally happen that you realize, okay, well, we thought we might have a claim against the surveyor. We sent a letter of claim, but they've come back with a letter of response, which does seem to be a fairly strong defense of saying it wasn't there. But that, again, strengthens the claim against the sellers because they had concealed it, so there was nothing for the surveyor to see. Or a nuisance claim. You might start off thinking it's a good case or a bad case, but then you might find that the defendant who you're pursuing, the neighbor for nuisance, says, well, actually, it did spread from that garden, and they're able to show some evidence to show it was actually the seller's fault all along if they'd lived there for a long period of time, in which case, again, it might strengthen the claim against the sellers. So I think really you have to keep an open mind at the beginning, work out who the defendants might be. Usually sensible to send a letter of claim to anybody that might be a defendant, see what they come back with. And often in terms of solicitors I work with, that's often then when they'll come to me and ask for an advice. And that's one of the things that I will advise them on, to say, OK, well, these are the defendants. These are the prospects against defendant one, two and three. And then you can take a view from there about who to issue and serve against. The final thing I would say on that is limitation. Again, going back to that topic, that might be relevant as well, because if you've got a client that comes to you late in the day and you don't have so long to bring proceedings against, say, the sellers in particular, it might be you need to issue protective proceedings. If it's early on, you might be thinking, well, actually, we can pursue defendant one. And if for some reason something happens, or maybe they've not cooperated, they don't give you any disclosure, so you do issue a claim, but then they suddenly produce a load of disclosure and you say, well, we'll agree not to continue the claim, and they pay your costs, whatever it may be, you would then still have time to pursue another claim against a different defendant. So it might, again, depend on that. But I think really the takeaway point would be keep an open mind, letters of claim to everybody that might be a defendant, and then really take a view after you've had the responses about what you want to do.
Brilliant. So it's not uncommon then at all to have multiple defendants.
No, it's really common. And yeah, often defendants are super quick to blame each other. They don't hold back from pointing the finger. So, you know, it's the classic surveyor blaming the seller, seller blaming the neighbour, everybody blaming each other. And you can sometimes play them off against each other. I mean, I've had cases where, going back to something I'd said about the sometimes worried about the seller not having enough money to actually satisfy a judgment, I've had cases where we've had that concern and we've actually not told the seller that, but used the threat of suing them as leverage for them to cooperate. And often they can cooperate and be amazingly helpful in terms of the history with the neighbour. So it might strengthen the nuisance claim, and you might actually have the seller cooperating as a whip to support your nuisance claim. Or it might be vice versa. You might have a slightly shaky nuisance claim and you think, well, we think we can establish liability, but there are different risks. And you might actually find that they will cooperate with you to say, well, we were liaising with the seller for years about this and they never cooperated, in which case they're really helping you with a misrep claim. So it's sometimes good to be a bit Machiavellian about it, but you'll be amazed how defendants don't really need too much encouragement to start pointing the finger, and it does sometimes end up that they really will help build a case for you.
Thanks so much, Tom. That actually completes our podcast series. So thank you so much, Tom, for joining me over the last couple of weeks.
No, thanks, Lauren. It's been really fun, and I hope people find it helpful.
No, absolutely. I'm sure our listeners have found this extremely beneficial. I certainly have anyway. But honestly, Tom, thank you very much. Thanks for listening, everybody.